local high school football star back in the day, and was as black as anyone in Minnesota, where less than 5% of the population was African American. He took pride in having been elected county sheriff 4 times. But it wasn't the kind of pride that would lead to a fall. It was shaded with humility and a sense of responsibility to the people who entrusted him with the job. Besides, his wife of 26 years, Rebecca, was able to detect oncoming arrogance when it was still just smug presumption, and she could chasten him with a look or a few loving words. He tried never to forget that his actions reflected on her and on their 2 children as well, which was another reason why he was dismayed that the higher authorities had left him with so little to do when locals would expect, rightly, a great deal from him. He worried that the investigation had too quickly narrowed to a single track, Cora Gunderson. He'd known Cora for 20 years. She wasn't capable of such horrific violence. Yes, but every human being was a mystery, each mind a maze of passages and secret rooms. No one ever really knew anyone or what they might be capable of doing, except for a spouse, and even then, not always. Cora worked wonders with special needs kids, and no one had an unkind word to say about her. Nevertheless, as much as Luther might not want to believe that either a worm of evil or madness had curled in the core of her, he was too much cop to rule it out. Little remained of her SUV, a twisted mass of steel and melted fiberglass, and even less remained of Cora. Too little to make a positive identification other than by DNA. Numerous witnesses who knew her well were willing to testify that she had been driving the burning expedition, that she had appeared to be laughing as she accelerated, and that no one else had been in the vehicle. Her house, in a more rural area of the county, was also being searched by the FBI. Right now, Luther could do nothing there but observe and be made to feel underfoot. At 6:42, after he had crossed the street to talk with the county fire marshal, more to have something to do than to gather any vital information, his phone rang. The caller, Rob Stassen, was the deputy whom Luther assigned to Cora's house to assist the feds.
"Sheriff, if maybe you're not too busy there, you should come on out here."
"Right now," Luther said. "The only difference between me and a hibernating bear is I don't have a cave. What's happening?"
"Nothing. That's just it. They're gone."
"Who's gone?"
"The FBI."
The feds had established an incident response staging center in the library on Main Street, half a block from the Veblen Hotel. From there, a contingent of 4 had set out for Cora Gunderson's house at 3:30. 2 additional special agents, among later arrivals from Quantico, laden with cases of equipment, had followed at 4:30. The house was not the scene of a crime, but the assumption had to be made that it was where planning had been done and preparations made. A first comb-through of the premises, if as thorough as a case of this importance required, should have taken the forensic team at least until midnight. As Luther looked down at his snow-caked boots and worked his cold toes to keep them from growing stiff, he turned away from the fire marshal and lowered his voice when he spoke into his phone.
"Did they say when they're coming back?"
"I don't think they are," Rob Stassen said.
Luther's intuition told him, had been telling him for a while, that something wasn't quite right about some of the federal agents. A few of them seemed dispassionate to a disturbing degree, detached from the horror all around them. Of course, investigators, like first responders, needed to remain composed and subdue their sharpest feelings. But even the most professional of them, hardened by dark experience, should be shaken and moved by such a scene as this. And though they might not express their distress and pity in words or give way to tears, their feelings should have been easily read in their faces. At least 4 of these faces, both men and women, were cemented with indifference, as though the minds behind their eyes were not capable of recognizing a common humanity between them and the blast-torn, fire-charred, broken victims pinned and lifeless in the rubble.
"I'm alone here now," Rob Stassen said. "There's a weird feeling about the place, Sheriff. You better come have a look around."
Chapter 23. The library lay quiet at the tail end of the afternoon, the banks of overhead lamps lit only in alternating rows, perhaps to save on the electricity bill, the many-paned tall windows little illuminated by the gray blear of the rain-washed day. There were aisles of book-laden shelves, though fewer than would have been the case in earlier decades, more space having been given over to DVDs, a storytelling corner for children, and, toward the back of the large main room, an array of computer workstations available to patrons. Smartphones and electronic tablets and laptops all had their unique identifiers and were locatable by authorities in real time. Therefore, Jane Hawke had resorted to library computers, browsing incognito since she'd been on the run and off the grid. Even so, if her search strings included certain people and things that her pursuers knew interested her, David James Michael, the company Far Horizons, nanomachines, brain implants, and others, she might trigger tripwire alarms at websites where her enemies abided, initiating their track-to-source security probes. Consequently, she kept her library visits short. She was alone among the workstations and hoped for solitude until she finished. 2 subjects of interest. The first was Randall Larkin, the attorney. When she hadn't called Lawrence Hennepin at noon, they probably concluded that she had brooded about her encounter with the journalist and decided not to trust him. They couldn't know that she had listened to his phone conversations with Larkin. Because she'd never worn eyeglasses before, the plain lens prop began to annoy her. The tabs irritated the bridge of her nose. The end piece on the right stem rubbed sore the skin behind her ear. Soon enough, she would go to ground for the night and take them off. The law firm, Woodbine, Kravitz, Larkin, and Benedetto, operated from an address on Little Santa Monica Boulevard in Beverly Hills. Randall Larkin's name led to numerous links. She jotted down salient details in a small notebook and soon had what she needed. Before moving to her second subject, after scoping the room to be sure that no one was within sight, she took off the glasses and massaged the indentations they had left on her nose. When Jane opened her eyes and put on the glasses, a woman stood not 15 feet away, at the end of an aisle of shelves, watching with a faint expression of puzzlement. Mid-30s, rubber-soled walking shoes, tan skirt, white blouse. She had a cart of books and was returning the volumes to their proper positions in the stacks. Jane smiled. The woman smiled. And Jane returned her attention to the monitor, affecting unconcern. She remained peripherally aware of the librarian as she quickly sought any news item about the death of Sakura Hennepin a year earlier and found what she needed. "Excuse me," the librarian said. She had moved closer, the book cart empty. "I'm just sure we've met, but I can't think where." Affecting a Texas accent, Jane said, "Darn if I didn't have the same feeling when I saw you. Ever lived in Dallas, thereabouts?" "No, always California. I'm staying with a friend up to Oakdale Avenue, a couple blocks off Satakoi, while I find my own place. You know Oakdale? Is that in Winnetka?" "Sure enough." The librarian shook her head. "I live in Canoga Park. Just next door. So maybe you and me shop groceries at the same pavilions." "No, I don't go there." Jane frowned, shrugged. "Hey, you figure maybe we knew each other in a previous life?" "Well, I've always felt drawn to ancient Egypt, pharaohs and the sphinxes and all that, as if I lived there once.
Maybe that's it, girl. Me and you and Tutankhamun.
They traded smiles, and Jane turned her attention once more to the computer, as if she still had work to do. The librarian drifted away, pushing the empty cart. She might have glanced back once. Jane watched her, only indirectly. As soon as the woman turned out of sight in the maze of stacks, heading toward the front desk, Jane shut down the computer, grabbed her large purse and umbrella. Loath to leave by the main entrance, she walked quickly to a door bearing a sign that promised restrooms. Beyond lay a corridor, egg crate overhead fixtures dropping cubes of light to glisten on the pale blue vinyl floor. At the nearer end, a glowing red sign above a door announced exit. Stepping out into the rain, she found a shallow parking lot that might have been for library employees. Her Ford Escape was two blocks away on a residential street. For just this reason, she never left it close to a library in which she conducted research. If they got a description of her vehicle, she would have to abandon it, steal a car, and drive to Nogales, Arizona to work a trade-in with Enrique de Soto. All the devils in hell, or at least their surrogates, were looking for her, however, and she didn't have time for Nogales. Without stopping to put up the umbrella, she hurried between two of the parked cars. As she splashed into the puddled alleyway, a man called out behind her, "Hey, you!" She glanced back and saw a guy in a uniform. Not a cop. Green and black uniform. Gun on his hip. Maybe a security guard. Did libraries have armed guards these days? Hell, yes. Even churches probably had armed security guards these days. A palisade of shops and restaurants backed up to the farther side of the alley. She raced past their back doors and dumpsters. The guard shouted. He was coming after her. Chapter 24. New drifts blanketed old, the layered bedding of a landscape deep in slumber, mounded as though with the forms of sleepers dreaming. The bone-pale, skeletonized limbs of winter-pasted trees, chokeberry and moosewood and gray poplars, and the storm-crusted boughs of evergreens, more white than black, not green at all in the night, rendered a monochromatic scene in the spectral light of the snowfields. In his sheriff's department jeep, Luther Tillman drove alone into the out-county, by the mile, further convinced that the mass murder at the Veblen Hotel was not an insane incident complete unto itself, but was only the beginning of something. The contentment and many pleasures of his much-blessed life rested on the thinnest ice. With no light in any window, Cora Gunderson's single-story white clapboard house, nestled in late winter swaddling, did not loom into view suddenly complete, but instead gradually articulated in the headlights. He turned onto the driveway, which had not been plowed, drove around to the back of the house, and parked behind Rob Stassen's jeep. He killed the headlights and the engine. Exhaust vapor plumed from the tailpipe and crystallized as Rob got out of his vehicle and closed the door. As Luther approached the deputy, Cora's long-haired dachshund sprang into the driver's seat of the jeep and peered out the side window with solemn interest.
"Dixie won't have had her dinner," the sheriff said.
"I thought of that."
Rob was 36, 10 years a Navy MP, before he had enough of foreign ports and came home to help keep the peace.
"I found her kibble. Had to coax her to eat. Even then, she wouldn't eat much. She trembles and whimpers, poor thing. It's like she knows."
"Dogs know," Luther agreed.
"Cora, of all people, Minnesota Teacher of the Year. It takes the wind out of you to think about it."
Heading toward the nearby back porch, snow crunching, squeaking as it compacted under his boots, Luther said,
"One way or another, this Cora today wasn't the Cora we knew."
"You mean like a brain tumor or something?"
"We'll never know. Not enough left of her for an autopsy."
The porch steps had been swept clear of snow, climbing them, Luther said.
No police notice on the door? No seal?
They were sort of going by the book at first, until that Hendrickson guy showed up. Then they went out of here with their tails between their legs.
What Hendrickson guy?
Booth Hendrickson from the Department of Justice. He must have cracked a whip. I don't know why.
The FBI was only a semi-independent agency under the authority of the Department of Justice.
You get his card? Luther asked.
He claimed he was out of them. Maybe he was. Too Harvard and Yale, if you ask me. But his justice ID looked real enough, and the specialists from Quantico knew him.
What did he say to them? Why did he pull them out?
Wasn't privy, Sheriff. To Hendrickson, I was just a mall cop. House is locked. He took the keys, so if you think we need to do this, we'll have to force the door. Maybe find an unlatched window.
Luther said Cora hid a key in case she got locked out. He picked up a long-handled, stiff-bristled brush that leaned against the wall, and he scraped the snow off his boots.
They already tracked it up pretty bad in there, sir.
We don't need to add to it, Robbie.
Rob Stassen used the brush while Luther felt for the key on the lintel ledge overhead. He unlocked the door, switched on the lights. Havoc in the kitchen. Melted snow puddled the linoleum. Partial muddy footprints overlapped like some antic mockery of abstract art. Cabinet doors stood open. The contents of the trash can had been turned out on the floor, gone through, and then left uncollected. Black fingerprint powder mottled the table, the refrigerator door, the cabinets. They would have been seeking prints other than Cora's, in case she'd had co-conspirators. Nitrile gloves, worn by investigators to avoid muddling the scene with their prints, had been stripped off and thrown on the floor or left on counters.
This look like the work of the FBI you know? Luther asked.
Scene's been contaminated, Sheriff. It's not movie FBI.
Maybe it hasn't been for a long time. Were they collecting evidence or eliminating it?
Lord alive. Did you really just ask that question?
Luther stood by the dinette table, considering a thick spiral-bound notebook that had been left open.
This is Cora's. Nobody I've ever known has handwriting half as neat as hers.
You'd think a machine wrote it, the deputy said.
For this entry, she had used only the front of each page. The left side of the revealed spread remained blank. On the right, starting at the top, she had written, "Sometimes at night, sometimes at night, sometimes at night," as if she had sat here in some quasi-autistic state, her mind stuck like an old-fashioned phonograph needle in one groove of a vinyl record, those three words filled line after line. Luther turned a page, then another, a fourth and fifth, all alike in content, until he came to where she continued the thought that she needed so badly to express. "Sometimes at night, I come wide awake. I come wide awake. I come wide awake." For six pages, Cora repeated only those last four words, which were formed time after time with eerie regularity. When Luther found new material, 8 pages later, Rob Stassen, standing beside him, said,
"I've got ice in my veins."
Chapter 25. With dusk rapidly coagulating behind the overcast, dark clouds having spent their fireworks, the sullen storm washed sour light upon the San Fernando Valley. Pursued by an armed security guard, Jane splashed through racing water that carried litter along the wide, shallow swale in the center of the alleyway, past a dumpster, at a steel door labeled Valentino Ristorante, deliveries. She sought entrance and was rewarded. Beyond lay a receiving room, maybe 20 feet wide and 10 deep, concrete floor and walls. Empty metal shelves to the left and right, an inner door that probably led to the kitchen, the aroma of garlic on the air. They would not be open for dinner yet, but the staff would be on site, preparing. She stepped to the left and put down her handbag and stood against the wall. The door swung toward her and thudded shut. If the guy coming after her wasn't a policeman moonlighting for a private security company, and if he wasn't former military, if he was the usual cop wannabe who had qualified for an armed response license, he would be too eager to prove himself. With an abundance of enthusiasm but little hard experience, he would charge in here under the assumption that she was bent on getting away through the restaurant and out the front door. If he was a wannabe, she hoped only that he didn't burst into the receiving room with his pistol ready. Some of these junior G-men lived to draw down on you, and some were half afraid of their guns. The lever handle rattled. The bottom flap of weather stripping scraped across the threshold with a sucking sound. The door opened, away from Jane. A wind-thrown spray of rain spattered into the receiving room. And there he was, 2 feet from her. He alerted to her presence when she pressed the spring release button and, in a fraction of a second, deployed the collapsible umbrella in his face. He cried out in surprise, perhaps not at once realizing what exploded at him. As black and sudden as the umbrella was, he might have thought that here came death incarnate, wings flaring to enfold him. He stumbled sideways and fell. Jane threw aside the umbrella and stepped on the fallen man's balls hard enough to make him wish he had long ago been neutered. "Don't make me hurt you worse," she said, keeping her foot on the jewels. She need not have been concerned, because the crotch shot had robbed him of all strength. She bent and tore the pistol from his holster, stepped back, and aimed the weapon at him as the outer door fell shut. "Stay on the floor. Take off your pants." Shocked, pale, wheezing in pain, he needed to hear her make the demand again before he understood, but he didn't scheme to the delay. As the security guard shucked off his pants, the inner door opened, and a middle-aged man with regal Roman features appeared, dressed in white and wearing a chef's hat, evidently having come to see what the commotion was about. His expression was that of anyone into whose hand had been thrust a stick of dynamite with a burning fuse. When the chef started to retreat, Jane swung the pistol toward him. "Stay where you are or take a bullet." "Please, don't. I have a dependent mother," he pleaded, raising his hands, holding the inner door open with his body. On his back on the floor, the guard struggled to get his rain-soaked pants off over his shoes, which might have struck Jane as farcical if she didn't have to worry that, back in the library, the Egyptophile had already phoned the police. To the chef, she said, "Pick up that umbrella and close it." He did as he said, and the guard freed himself from his pants. "Chef, throw the umbrella over there by that handbag on the floor. Don't even think about throwing it at me." He would have been a champion at horseshoes. The umbrella hit the handbag. To the guard, she said, "Off with the boxer shorts."
"Jeez, don't make me."
"You know who I am?" she demanded.
Yeah, I know."
"So I'm desperate. Naked or dead? Your choice. Quick." He skinned out of the shorts. "Get up." Wincing, sucking air between his clenched teeth, he needed the metal shelves to pull himself to his feet. He couldn't yet stand straight. "Pick up your pants and shorts," she ordered. "Open the door. Throw them out to the middle of the alleyway." He did as she required. And when she told him to sidle over to the chef, he obeyed that command as well, though he declared with inarguable sincerity that he hated her. Blocking the outer door from fully closing, Jane said, "You're breaking my heart," and picked up the handbag and umbrella with her left hand. "Chef, do I smell Brujol?"
"It's a special tonight.
Sure wish I could stay for it." She slipped out of the receiving room, tossed the guard's pistol into the dumpster, and ran through sheeting rain that seemed colder than it had been 2 minutes earlier. Wind had blustered up in her brief absence, now that the door of night was swinging open, and it gusted along the alleyway, huffing like some phantom herd that had spooked into stampedes across this territory centuries before the first human being had set foot on it. Chapter 26. The Dead Woman's Kitchen. Cold, waxy bacon fat, thick in a frying pan on the stove. Pale nitrile gloves cast off by bureau agents, draped on chair backs and depending from counter edges and puddled on the floor, as if they were the collapsed remains of anemone-like sea creatures displaced from a distant ocean by means unknowable. Dirty plate and flatware on the table, left by a woman known to be uncommonly neat. And the journal, containing thousands of repetitions of the phrases and clauses with which she laboriously constructed a message, evidence of an obsessive need to convey a condition or experience that frightened and oppressed her. Sometimes at night, I come wide awake. Sheriff Luther Tillman turned 5 pages before he found a further construction of the sentence, which was when Rob Stassen said, "I've got ice in my veins." On the page, "Sometimes at night, I come wide awake, and I feel a spider crawling inside my skull." Luther said,
"The FBI must have pored through this. They aren't so incompetent they'd have overlooked it."
"But then they would have taken it with them," Rob said. "Lord alive, it's a key piece of evidence."
The FBI's behavior was inexplicable. But Luther was more focused on the awfulness of what they had found here, saddened to read this evidence that Cora Gunderson had indeed been suffering from mental illness of one kind or another. He turned 3 pages before he found the point at which she had managed to extract from herself the next part of the sentence. "Sometimes at night, I come wide awake, and I feel a spider crawling inside my skull, and it speaks to me." 2 pages later, there was more, and 3 pages after that, and 4 pages after that, until her handwriting ended and all the remaining pages of the journal were blank. Luther read aloud the complete message.
"Sometimes at night, I come wide awake, and I feel a spider crawling inside my skull, and it speaks to me, speaks in an evil whisper. I believe it's laying eggs in the folds of my brain. It tells me to sleep, and so I do. I forget the spider for days at a time, until I come wide awake again at night and feel it crawling, feel it squeezing out its eggs in my brain. And the spider says, 'Forget me.' The spider will be the death of me."
The refrigerator compressor switched on, and Luther looked up with a start.
"Poor Cora," said Rob Stassen. "Sounds strange to say that, considering what she did today. But Lord alive, she was sure sick. What now, Sheriff?"
Closing the journal, tucking it under his arm, Luther said,
"Now we look through this place from end to end and see what else the FBI didn't think was important."
Chapter 27. Jane needed a plain-wrap motel offering anonymity but minus cockroaches, where she could say she didn't have a credit card and could pay cash without raising suspicion. The entire San Fernando Valley was too hot for her after the business with the security guard. She avoided freeways flooded with traffic seeping around uncounted rain-related accidents. She drove west to Woodland Hills and took State Highway 27 south through the Santa Monica Mountains to the Coast Highway. Will Rogers State Beach was closed. A chain between stanchions restricted access to the parking lot. The terrain lay inhospitable to both sides of the access lanes, but she piloted the escape around the blockade. She turned off the headlights and drove slowly into the parking lot, through whirling skirts of coastal mist. The shape of a structure gathered out of the fog, the public restrooms. She backed up to the building's overhang and got out in the rain with her tote. At the tailgate, she retrieved one of 2 suitcases and the bag of wigs. She could hear the ocean spending itself repeatedly on the shore, but she could not see the breaking surf through the fog. There would be cameras at the entrance or outside this comfort station, or in both places. They weren't likely to get a clear image in this weather, Anyway, she wouldn't damage anything, so there was no reason for them to review later the video from this lonely hour. The Lockade lock-release gun defeated the deadbolt guarding the women's facility. Inside, she switched on only the bank of lights above the row of sinks. The air smelled of disinfectant, underlaid with a urinous odor. She opened the suitcase on the counter between two sinks and took from it a 13-gallon trash bag that she used when wardrobe changes were necessary en route. She put aside the baseball cap, took off her sport coat and the shoulder rig with pistol, stripped out of her sweater and jeans and stuffed them into the bag with the sodden coat. She stepped out of the rock ports but didn't take off her wet socks, wanting a barrier between her and a floor that needed a hard scrubbing. After donning dry jeans, a dry sweater, her rig, and a fresh sport coat, she tied on the wet shoes. The auburn hair would be known to the police now. The rain had washed the curl out of it, but she would have to dye it soon. From the bag of wigs supplied by the faux Syrian refugees in Reseda, Jane chose a chopped every-which-way jet black number, a high-style Vogue version of a punk do. In spite of having been in that gnome-guarded house where cigarettes were worshipped, the lush hair smelled clean, because Lois, she of the pink sweatsuit, kept the wigs in a refrigerator set aside for that purpose. Jane pinned up her own hair, fitted the wig, quickly brushed it, studied herself in the mirror, and believed the new her. Now a little eyeshadow with a subtle blue tint and lipstick to match. The horn-rimmed glasses and baseball cap would have to be put away for a future incarnation. She fixed a fake nose ring to the nare of her right nostril, a silver serpent with one tiny ruby eye. Of the 6 forged driver's licenses, she chose the one with a photo that matched her hairstyle. She was now Elizabeth Bennett of Del Mar, California, and put it in her wallet. Among the contents of her pockets that she'd put on the counter before changing, a cameo carved in soapstone was the last one she retrieved. It was half of a broken locket found by her son, Travis, where he was being hidden by dear friends. He thought that the shape and profile resembled his mother, that it must have been good luck to find it among the smoothed stones at a stream's edge. The resemblance eluded her. Nevertheless, she accepted the gift and promised always to keep it with her, that it might protect her and ensure that she returned to him. She kissed the cameo now, as one might kiss a religious medal or the cross dangling from a rosary, kissed it again, and held it tight in her fist for a moment, before stowing it in a pocket of her jeans. Because the Ford's tailgate was under the building overhang, she loaded everything into the back without getting wet, and she dashed to the driver's door. 10 minutes from arrival to departure. After a harrowing day, she felt somewhat confident about making it safely through the night. As the most wanted criminal in America, however, she would find tomorrow challenging, especially considering what she had planned for Randall Larkin. Chapter 28. If the contents and condition of Cora Gunderson's modest house said one thing about her, it was that she lived a simple life of small pleasures. She cherished the company of her dog, Dixie Belle, for whom she'd purchased numerous toys and colorful small sweaters, memorializing their lives together in half a dozen photo albums. She enjoyed doing needlepoint wall hangings, subscribed to guideposts, and covered one wall with framed photographs of dozens of the most loved students she had taught over the years. Although the woman was gone now, and her right to have her secrets had been surrendered less by the fact of her death than by what she'd done to those people at the Veblen Hotel, Sheriff Luther Tillman nonetheless felt guilty of violating her privacy, as he and Rob Stassen opened drawers and inspected closets and moved through the small house. She'd had little and wanted nothing more, and her modesty was inherent everywhere he looked. They came across no other item as strange as the journal found on the kitchen table, although in the bedroom were 30 additional spiral-bound notebooks of a different character. Bookshelves covered one wall from floor to ceiling. Hardcovers and paperbacks occupied the higher shelves. But the bottom shelf held 9x12 300-page journals filled with Cora's precise handwriting. Luther examined a few, and Rob paged through a few others, and they both reached the same conclusion. Over the past 2 decades, the teacher had written short stories and entire novels at a prodigious pace.
"Don't manuscripts have to be typed?" Rob wondered. "Maybe she had them typed up by someone else. Did she ever publish anything?" "I never heard of it," Luther said, turning pages. "This much rejection would have been tough." "Maybe she wasn't rejected." "What? You think she published under a pen name?" "Maybe she never tried to be published."
Rob read a few lines and said dismissively, "It's sure not Louis L'Amour." Luther had been gripped by the opening paragraph of a short story and found himself wanting to read further.
"Maybe it's not Louis L'Amour, but it's something."
Chapter 29. A motel in Manhattan Beach, nowhere near the sand. Drab room and sway-backed queen-size bed, but clean and bug-free, at least until the lights were off. Rain in the night like 10,000 voices of a restless populace, the gusting wind a fierce orator urging them to violence, as it periodically rattled a nearby metal awning and banged a loose shutter on an abandoned building across the street. More deli takeout, heavy on the protein. Coke with vodka. As she ate, Jane reviewed her notes on the death of Sakura Hanifin and on the life in general of Randall Larkin, Lawrence Hanifin's friend. Everyone connected to the billionaire David Michael lived in a mirror maze of deceit, each of them casting multiple reflections, no two alike, social and political elites whose secret lives, their true lives, were conducted in the gutter. If her loathing were a poison, they would all be dead. With her second Coke and vodka, she switched on the TV to see what cable news had to offer besides stories about her, and for the first time, learned of the incident in Minnesota, where the death toll now stood at 46. A beloved teacher plotting a mass murder, one of those not in the name of Allah, had the hallmarks of a suicide attack programmed by a nanomachine implant. Cora Gunderson had been Minnesota Teacher of the Year. Maybe the conspirator's computer model pegged her as one who, at least in some small way, would push society in a direction of which they disapproved. And among those she'd incinerated were a governor and a congressman with reputations as reformers. Those chosen for elimination were on what the conspirators called the Hamlet List, a fact Jane had learned from one of the two men she'd killed in self-defense the previous week. With the self-righteous air of a politician justifying graft as a form of social justice, he had explained that if someone had killed Hamlet in the first act of Shakespeare's play, more people would have been alive at the end. They seemed really to believe that this ignorant literary interpretation justified the murder of 8,400 people a year. They were intellectuals, excited by ideas more important to them than people. Self-identified intellectuals were among the most dangerous people on the planet. The problem was, all intellectuals first self-identified as such before others accepted their status and sought them for words of wisdom. They didn't need to pass a test to confirm their brilliance, didn't appear before a credentialed board by which they needed to be certified. It was easier to be celebrated as an intellectual than to get a hairdresser's license. Jane turned off the TV, sickened. Something in the newscaster's demeanor suggested that their solemn expressions and measured voices and emotional pauses were calculated, that each of them, down where the perpetual inner child and the reptile consciousness overlapped, was excited to be on air when tragedy spiked the ratings, when they could imagine that they were part of history. Wigless, in t-shirt and panties, she sat in bed to finish her drink, listening to the rain and the quarreling wind and the traffic in the street. She closed her eyes and saw her son sleeping in the safe house of the friends no one could connect to her, saw the two German shepherds that lived there as well, imagined one of the dogs sleeping in the bed with the boy. As in ancient Europe, a she-wolf had slept with the abandoned baby Romulus and kept him safe that he might live to found the city of Rome. Chapter 30. Just after 11 o'clock that evening, with Rebecca and Jolie asleep upstairs, Sheriff Luther Tillman sat shoeless but still in his uniform at his kitchen table, immersed in another short story by Cora Gunderson. The first two had been elegantly realized. This third might prove to be the best one yet. At times, the prose sang in his mind's ear, and when he spoke it aloud, it sounded through the room with no less melody. He wondered at the teacher's long-harbored secret, that she could have filled 30 thick journals with fiction of a quality that any publisher would have rushed to print, but evidently had never said a word about her writing to anyone. As outgoing as she had been, as deeply involved with her community, she had also lived another life of feverish creation, alone but for her dog and the dog before Dixie Bell, creating a world of vivid characters to people her solitude. As if Luther had spoken her name aloud, Dixie whined and looked up from her bed, which she had brought from Cora's place and put in a corner of the kitchen.
"Go back to sleep, little one," he said,
and the dog sighed and lowered her head. He had brought 10 of the journals home with him, plus the one in which Cora obsessively wrote about her paranoid certainty that a spider was laying eggs deep in her brain. In the morning, he would need to go back to her house and gather her remaining journals. He couldn't understand how a woman who had written so sensitively and so well could have driven that SUV bomb into the Veblen Hotel. As one who believed that any crime was a twisted growth with roots that could be unearthed, he felt sure that somewhere in these spiral-bound volumes, evidence could be found of her first instability, when the paranoia had begun. Perhaps not just when, but also why. Seated in a charger on a nearby kitchen counter, his smartphone rang at 11:48. He turned in his chair and snared the phone and took the call. Deputy Lonnie Burke, assigned to one of the out-county patrol routes, reported that Cora Gunderson's house was ablaze and that it was unquestionably a case of arson. Chapter 31. To Luther Tillman, this looked like more than an act of feeble vengeance perpetrated by some kin of those who died at the hotel. With shingles, rafters, joists, studs, wallboard, doors, cabinets, furniture having been rendered into ashes and windblown to the far reaches of the night, the concrete slab issued a phosphorescent glow, as if from moonlight. But the moon remained submerged in clouds. The pale glow was retained heat, still so intense that window glass lay on the concrete in glistering puddles, just now starting to shape into whorls and ripples, and all the metal of ovens and refrigerator and cookpots, of even the furnace made for fire, lay in low, half-melted masses, radiant and strange. For a distance of 15 yards, the snow around the residence had gone to steam and water, and the frozen ground had turned to mud. Farther out, a mantle of ash and filigrees of soot darkened winter's coverlet. In front of the house, the pair of old starburst pines stood stripped of greenery, jagged and bristling and black and smoking like ancient totems, the ground around them littered with their dismembered limbs transformed to charcoal. The firemen had been defeated before they arrived, had been able to do nothing but watch the last of the inferno burn itself out. They were still present, however, as though superstitiously expecting that such an unnaturally fierce blaze might leap up anew, even though it had consumed everything combustible. Out where the driveway met the county road, propped against the mailbox, was a message from the arsonists, white letters painted on a slab of plywood. "Burn in hell, you murderous bitch." Vance Saunders, who years earlier had been in charge of fire control on an aircraft carrier, said no ordinary accelerant could fuel such a fire.
"Even had they soaked every room with gasoline," he told Luther, "she'd never go up like this one up. There was something kind of napalm about this."
After the firemen left, Lonnie Burke walked with Luther to their cruisers.
"If we give this a case number, then everyone who knew anyone who died at the hotel, he's a suspect in this here arson." "Whoever did this, they aren't county people," Luther said.
Puzzled, Lonnie said,
"Who are they, then?"
Recalling how the FBI had been pulled out of the house by a man from the U.S. Department of Justice, their investigation prematurely terminated, Luther said,
"Maybe we won't ever know, and maybe we don't need to."
After Lonnie returned to his patrol route, Luther slowly drove home through this high-latitude night, where, in clear weather, he sometimes stood transfixed by a sky coruscating with the aurora borealis. He knew that those luminous streamers of color were only charged solar particles bombarding the upper atmosphere and flowing along Earth's magnetic lines of force, but the sight never failed to fill him with wonder. You could know the science of a thing and still find the phenomenon mysterious and mystical and feel small and vulnerable in the face of it. He was only halfway home when he phoned Rob Stassen, with whom he had searched Cora Gunderson's house earlier. When Rob answered, not yet abed, Luther said,
"It's me."
Talking around a mouthful of something, Robbie said,
"Yes, sir. Just watching some dumb TV."
"Is that a cud?"
"Doritos and guacamole."
"Listen, did you tell anyone what we found in Cora's place?"
"Checked out, came home, crashed. Haven't talked to anyone."
"No one at all? It's important."
"No one. Except maybe myself."
"What about Melanie?"
"She's off in Idaho, visiting her mom, remember?"
"I do now, yes." Cora's house just burned to the ground.
"Why am I not surprised? People are stupid. You need me there?"
"No. What I need is you don't tell anyone we were in that house earlier. No one. Not a word about the journals we found."
"You got it. I'm dead serious, Robbie."
"I can hear you are, Sheriff. You spooked me a little."
"Good.
We didn't even have this conversation."
"What conversation?"
Luther terminated the call. The closer he got to home, the faster he drove, although he didn't realize that he expected to discover something gone terribly wrong at his house, with his family, until he arrived and found that all was well. Chapter 32. Jane dreamed of Nick, the love of her life, a good and vivid dream, tactile, as dreams rarely were, his hand on her throat, her breast, a kiss bestowed on her bare shoulder, his face radiant in the amber half-light and fluid shadows of a nameless place, and she, enraptured not by desire, but by a sense of safety in his arms. But then, when he spoke, her expectation that his words would be those of her love and lover was not fulfilled, and he possessed instead the hateful voice of the man who, 2 months earlier, had met and charmed Travis and had later threatened Jane by phone. "He's a wonderfully trusting child, and so very tender, Sheerly, for the fun of it, we could pack the little bugger off to some third-world snake pit, turn him over to a group like ISIS or Boko Haram. Nick's tender touch had become rough, and when she tried to pull away from him, he held her fast. Some of those badasses are as fond of little boys as much as they are of little girls. His eyes were no longer Nick's eyes, but viperous and cold. He might be passed around until he's 10 or 11 before some barbarian tires of him and finally cuts off his pretty head. In a sweat, she sat up from the dream and could not turn the lights on fast enough, fumbling with one bedside lamp and then the other. Though she was alone, she drew the pistol from under the pillow on which Nick's head would have rested if he had been alive and with her. According to the digital clock, it was 4:08 a.m. She would sleep no more this night. The wind had escorted the rain to another part of the world. There was not even traffic noise from the street, nor any sound from an adjacent motel room. The Southern California hive now stilled in anticipation of the dawn. She had been propelled awake not by the fact that the dream became a nightmare, but by a realization that had eluded her when awake, yet had come to her in sleep. Nick had been intelligent and tough-minded, with a profound sense of responsibility to his family, and yet, having been identified by the computer model as a candidate for the Hamlet list, having been at some point injected with a control mechanism, having been directed to self-destruct, he had done it. Therefore, what if instead he'd been directed to commit murder-suicide, as this woman in Minnesota had done? What if Nick had been told to slaughter his wife and child before taking his own life? That was a what-if on which she refused to dwell. With the pistol in hand, she thrust up from the creaking bed and navigated the room as if hidden traps lay everywhere about to spring. In the bathroom, she turned on the light and swept aside the lime-scaled shower curtain, certain that no one waited there, but nonetheless compelled to look. She put the gun on the laminate top of the vanity and cranked on the cold water and cupped her hands and pressed her face into the bowl of palms and fingers, as though to wash away the tormenting what-if. Watching the clear beads drip off her face and spatter against the chipped porcelain sink, she could too easily imagine they were drops of blood. The trouble with the what-if game was that once you began to play it, you couldn't just quit whenever you wanted. From one what-if grew another. In some future confrontation, what if they captured her and injected a control mechanism? What if then they told her to return to her little boy and kill him and then kill herself? Or what if they told her to kill him but not herself, to live thereafter with the knowledge of what she had done to him after he had rushed into her embrace? She had thought she understood all that was at risk, but the poets and the sages agreed that hell had several levels, and she had just glimpsed a deeper stratum than those she had seen before. Chapter 33. Sheriff Luther Tillman had never needed, and never had the patience to endure, what others thought of as a full night's sleep. Instead, he functioned well on 4 or 5 hours, with an occasional 6. Sleep was rest to him, yes, but it also felt like a taste of death, waking to discover that, for hours, the world had gone on just fine without him, as one day it would go on forever. In a pinch, he could skip an entire night's sleep with little ill effect. This would be one of those nights. At 1:10 a.m. Friday, having returned from the ruins of Cora Gunderson's house, he brewed coffee and put a tin of butter cookies on the kitchen table. He sat there to read more of the teacher's writing. Page by page, Cora's fiction didn't just entertain, but also educated him as to the complexity of her mind and the generosity of her heart. If he thought he had known her well, he found now that he'd hardly known her at all. It was as if he had waded out into a knee-deep pond with a placid surface, only to discover immeasurable depths teeming with life. Yet nothing he read helped to explain what she had done. In fact, the beauty of her fiction made the ugliness of her actions more difficult to comprehend. So that shortly after 4:30 in the morning, he put aside her stories and returned to the journal in which she had struggled for so long to pry out of herself the four sentences about a spider crawling within her skull. When he and Robbie Stassen had considered these words while standing in Cora's kitchen, they had scanned quickly through the repetitions, which because of her precise cursive formed a pattern that lulled the eye, but that changed dramatically when a new phrase began. Now, he perused the pages with greater care, line by line, looking for he knew not what. In time, he was rewarded with the word iron where the word inside should have been. A spider crawling iron my skull. He would have thought it meant nothing, a mere error, except that 20 lines farther, the word appeared in the same place, and later, in another phrase entirely, speaks in an iron whisper where it replaced the word evil. In every investigation, a good cop looked for patterns, and for the lack of patterns where patterns ought to be, and often, as now, he came upon telling clues. After he had found 20 instances of the word iron where it didn't belong, he encountered the word furnace, where the word whisper should have been, and then, in place of the words my brain. There were 19 instances of furnace, before he discovered a third word embedded like code within the thousands of repetitions. For days at a time became instead for days at a lake. That same substitution occurred 22 places in 11 pages. Although Luther proceeded line by line through the remaining pages of the journal, he found nothing else of interest. Iron, furnace, lake. Cora's struggle to express her bizarre fear that a spider was colonizing her brain appeared to be the work of a woman bewildered by her own rapidly developing paranoia, perhaps embarrassed by it, frightened not just of the imaginary spider, but also of her belief in its existence, which part of her must have known was irrational. The embedding of a place name within the pages of repetitive writing seemed like a different matter, as if while she consciously attempted to leave behind her a statement about the spider, her subconscious strove to transmit from its darker reaches the name of a place that either she had forgotten or she resisted remembering. Having found this much, Luther didn't know what it might mean, if it meant anything at all, or how he might go about establishing a connection between her paranoid fear and her assault on the hotel. Anyway, there was no point in conducting such an inquiry. The unlikely perpetrator was dead. She couldn't mount a defense based on an insanity plea. He had no need to prepare for a trial. He couldn't let it go, however, because of the FBI's inadequate inspection of Cora's house, because of the Department of Justice official who ordered the Bureau agents to cease and desist, and not least of all, because someone had torched the house with a vengeance, destroying everything in it, and tried to make it appear as if vindictive locals had done the job. Luther had gotten into police work because he believed in the rule of law. A civil society could not endure without it. When the rule of law was diminished, the strong preyed on the weak. If the rule of law collapsed, every barbarism would ensue, and the streets would run with blood in such volume that all apocalyptic, biblical plagues and disaster movie horrors would seem by comparison to be the musings of naive children. He had long watched with concern as those who were corrupt became bolder in their thieving and lust for power, as corruption spread to institutions once immune to it. He had two daughters. He had a wife. He could not turn away from this case merely because higher authorities had removed it from his jurisdiction, nor because finding the truth of the assault on the hotel